This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Right On, showcasing the work of Otago Southland writers. I'm Beverly Martins. Join me for news and interviews with local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and replayed the following Sunday at 1pm. Right On is brought to you by the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and kindly supported by the great team at the University Bookshop.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Hello and welcome to this month's edition of Right On. My name is Beverly Martins and very delighted to have you tuning in. This month's show, we are joined with two guests, and the first one, of course, is Ian Doherty, who is a local historian and journalist and writer, and has got an amazing back catalogue of something like, I think, 30 books, isn't it, Ian?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, he's probably lost track. So Ian has got a master's degree in history and postgraduate journalism qualifications and has spent some time working up in Wellington for the Department of Internal Affairs, etc. And then kind of seemed that you came back to the region in about 2000, is that right?
Yep, about 20 years ago, yeah.
Right, what drew you back?
This was home. I mean, I left here in the 1970s and I hated the place. I thought it was very small and provincial and couldn't wait to leave. And then about 20 years ago, I realised that this is everything that I wanted. One of everything, but not too big. It's just, this is home to me.
Gosh, that's interesting. I couldn't agree more because I had my career in Auckland and Wellington and I came back down here about 15 years ago and I felt exactly the same way because I was actually brought up in central Otago and couldn't wait to leave and did, you know, everything career-wise in a different place. And then just, I don't know, I just kind of met Dunedin at the time that I think it was changing and yet it's still the right size. And it, as you say, it has what you need. And it has a really supportive community down here.
It feels like home, yes.
Yeah, great, yeah. So, and also Southland, which actually I don't know as much about. You're very embedded in Southland too, aren't you?
I've lived in Invercargill and at Waikawa on the southeast coast, just at the bottom of the Catlins there, which I loved. Yeah, I love the Otago Southland region.
Right. And a lot of your books are sort of local histories of things that have occurred in the region or of families and things like that. Do you want to talk about some of the ones that kind of stand out for you and why that you've worked on?
I think one of the first books I wrote on William James O'Leary, better known as Zarawatta Bill. I loved that book at the time and other people seem to like it too. It's been in continuous print since 1996, which is...
That's amazing, and it's still available.
It's still available as a print book and an e-book, and the feedback I've had is really positive. So, I love that one, but I also love the commercial benefit that I've derived from writing it.
Right, that it's been a long-staying one.
It's been a good seller,
Yes, because I guess some of your ones are quite specific to an institution that you might have done the history of something like the Citizens Advice Bureau, I think is one, and there's plenty of others, so that they have a kind of they're probably commissioned at a time for a centenary or a reason to do that at the time.
These are, I think the Citizens Advice was, they were 25 years old and they wanted to mark that, and so they got someone to write a history. A few centennial histories, Presbyterian Support Otago were 100, so the late Jane Thompson and I wrote that, and the Workers' Educational Association in Christchurch, again, they were 100 years old, and so they get someone in like me to write a centennial history. And it's good. I mean, it's interesting to work on it, but you also get paid as though it's a real day job as opposed to trying to put together a bit of part-time time to write a book yourself.
And how do you kind of guesstimate that? Because, of course, once you go into something like this, you wouldn't know what archival material is available or not, or which people are available or not. You know, how do you always find that they take much longer than you've allowed for, or do you, you're so experienced that you know that now?
With contracted work, if you've got a year, then that's the time you spend. Wow. You've got 6 months to do the research, and there's always something else you're chasing, but you've got to say no. I've got 6 months to do the research, I've got 6 months to do the writing, and it's the discipline of not going off on tangents and saying, oh no, I've got to check this, I've got to do that. You've got to just say, no, I've got this amount of time to do this amount of work. With your own books,
Sorry to interrupt there. Did you mean on that specific project or other projects that are happening at the time? You mean within that?
On that specific book, you've got 12 months to write a centennial history, because in 12 months' time, they're going to be gathering and they're going to be celebrating their 100 years and they want a book there. And so there's a discipline of getting it done in the 12 months.
Right.
There's no point in finishing it the week after they celebrate their, you know, their Labour weekend anniversary.
The week before is so
much
better.
The week before is good.
Yes.
And you've got printing and proofreading and all that sort of stuff to do as well. But with my own books, I just love it because there's no deadline. Many of them these days I publish myself, so I'm the publisher, so I'm not giving myself a hard time, where is it, where is it? And it's quite relaxing, and you can do other things and do it at your leisure, working the equivalent of full-time, but maybe over two or three times that amount of time, over 3 or 4 years doing a year's work.
Do you not lose the thread of things?
No. I love it. I love coming back to stuff like that. And I think if I worked full-time for 40 years full-time as a writer of books, I would have got sick of it, but I still love formatting a title page to a book. I still love writing that first paragraph. I love writing the preface because it helps me sort out what on earth the book is about.
Right,
and what
the kind of summary. So
I still get that buzz, yeah, which I think I would have lost if I had have worked, you know, 40 hours a week for 40 years writing books.
Right, that's amazing. Now, what are some of the personal books, like the passions and interests that you've done that are dear to your heart?
Generally, Otago, Southland, history, and Dunedin individuals, biographies. I've written a few biographies of Dunedin people. Well, Bill O'Leary was sort of a Dunedin person. He spent the last few years of his life here. But Rutherford Waddell, the Presbyterian minister in Dunedin, who started campaigning for improving the lot of women in the clothing industry, and that led to a nationwide anti-sweated labour campaign, and it led to the Liberal government in the 1890s passing legislation to protect workers from exploitation. And, you know, that is just a real buzz for me, writing a book about Rutherford Waddell. I've written a book recently on James Brown, the 19th century Dunedin cartoonist, who deserved to have a book because no one had bothered. And he was important. He was important for Dunedin, but also for cartooning in this country. That sort of thing. A.H. Reid.
Yes.
I met very briefly when I was at primary school and at high school. And, you know, a celebrated Dunedin writer, publisher, long-distance walker. And, again, I just loved writing a book about him, a man that I'd met when I was a kid and got a buzz over that as well.
Brilliant. So I know that you were here on the show interviewed by Vanda about 4 years ago about the Art Forger. Do you want to talk about that just briefly?
I wrote that one straight after the Rutherford Waddell book, and I thought a bit of variety, you know, a saint, I better do one on a sinner. I did one on Carl Sim. I'd met Carl, and I thought that that he was worth a book. I'd read about him in the paper, but there was much more to what he'd been up to than what was reported during his trial for art forgery. So that was interesting. You know, you do get a distorted view of the world if you just write about good people. So that was quite sobering to look at someone from the other side of the fence.
Actually, that sort of leads me to a secondary question then about some of the local histories that you've done and perhaps of family histories and things. Is there a tension sometimes with the people that have commissioned you that they want a sanitised? I mean, do you sometimes come across information that isn't quite as, positive as they would have hoped?
You come across that occasionally, but you hope people realise that, you know, history is warts and all, and most people are pretty good. I've had one, and I won't mention which book it was, but I've had one example where someone thought it was more an advertising feature, that I was a public relations firm rather than a historian writing that warts and all history that we're obliged to do. But generally, people are pretty good. They understand that you've got a job to do, which is to tell the truth and without fear or favour, and that's the ideal, and most people accept that.
And also to, I guess, try and work in some humanity and humour if you can.
I quite like doing that as much as I can without, you know, taking the piss.
And being flippant.
Yeah.
Right, so that leads us to talk about your latest publication, which is actually an update about Baldwin Street, called The Steepest Street in the World. And I'd like you to just outline, Ian, why it is that you felt it needed updating.
Oh, well, I wrote it I wrote an article for the Christchurch Press more than 20 years ago on Baldwin Street, and that got me thinking that it deserved more than that. So I wrote a book in 2006, the original one, and then it sold out pretty quickly, and I thought one day I will do an updated version. But the controversy over the Welsh Street, which I won't try to pronounce, being given the title by Guinness World Records. Yes, it was, yeah. And, well, coming up to 4 years it'll be. And then taking the title back and giving it back to Baldwin Street, I thought that's a good time to do an updated, expanded version, including that controversy.
For the listeners that don't, who are further afield and perhaps don't know, we've always claimed that Baldwin Street in the North East Valley is the steepest street in the world, and there are different engineering measurements of that, and we were in the Guinness World Records book, and then it was challenged by someone in Wales, and it took an engineer from a dogged engineer, actually, from the Dunedin City Council to say, no, actually we are, because you measure it in different ways to do with the Canberra, and they were measuring it from one part of the street, and, you know, so we did reclaim it, which in terms of the cruise ship tourist industry here in Dunedin is kind of massive, because it was bit of an embarrassment for it to be, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, while that was going on. Is that right, Ed?
Yeah, we were starting to say, well, it's the steepest street in the Southern Hemisphere,
right,
and things like that.
Yeah.
But yes, it was. Although people still were walking up it, not as many, but people were still walking up what was once the steepest street, still the steepest street in New Zealand at that stage, and the Southern Hemisphere. So, yes, but, I mean, Guinness World Records did the right thing eventually, because as Tony Stott, the person you mentioned, a surveyor, not with the city council, but a surveyor in Dunedin, said, look, it's not fair if you measure on the inside curve of a curved street with the camber of the road, it's steeper on the inside than it is going up the middle. And it's not fair to measure apples and pears, you know, because Baldwin Street is straight.
Yeah.
So what he knew was that professional engineers will measure a street in the centre line, which seems the fair thing to do. And Guinness World Records finally agreed that that was the fair thing to do.
The cruise ship season, I'm saying that is kind of because that is when you get the busloads of people. Obviously, you get local visitors and locals and, you know, visitors to Dunedin, but there is a surge between October and March every year, and buses stop at the bottom and, you know, thank goodness they haven't put toilets in down at the bottom of Baldwin Street now, because it's quite the crowd. And they were just surging up there. And I think it's something like 100,000 visitors a year go up and down Baldwin Street.
That's the total. But during the cruise ship season, the summer season, the number of people going up would be much greater than in the winter time. But that's the average, about 100,000 a year, according to the visitor centre, yes.
And there's been, obviously because it's there and people want to conquer it in a kind of Everest sort of way, there's been lots of amazing different races and things that go up there, different modes of transport. Do you want to just talk about some of those, Ian?
Oh, we did have the famous Gut Buster, which was people running up, a race up to the top and back down again every year. But people have gone up in on pogo sticks and unicycles and stilts. And one chap, one of the steampunk people from Oamaru, tried to go up on a penny farthing bicycle.
Oh, my goodness.
And came a bit of a cropper very early on that steeper part.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, skateboards and three-wheeled motorised trikes, and You name it, people have tried to get up there and succeeded, many of them, in getting up there. And then we had, of course, the famous Jaffa race, not people, but
Cadbury's factory is still here.
Confectionery racing down the street. It's been fun times.
And obviously the sort of counter side of that is the fact that, you know, if you live on that street, can get a bit annoying having people, you know, walking past your lounge all the time. How does that resolve itself?
I think people are resigned to having lots of people going up and down the street, not so resigned to people coming and peering in their windows or trampling on their garden flowers, backing into their walls and knocking them over, driving vehicles, not deliberately, through their fences.
Right.
When people get...
This is all in the book, is it?
When people conk out partway up. But, if you have moved there since 1987, when it became the steepest street in the world, you would know that that's what you're buying into. I think there's a resigned acceptance these days from most people there.
Right, yeah. So I want to talk about some of your upcoming projects and things. So just to briefly recap, the steepest street in the world, $20 at all good bookshops, including UBS, obviously, but also they can get it direct from you, can't they?
Saddle Hill Press. When I publish my own books, I call myself Saddle Hill Press, and they can contact me via that if they just Google Saddle Hill Press.
I think the email, it's all one word, is saddlehillpress@extra.co.nz.
It is, yes.
The $20 includes postage, so it's a bargain. It's got some beautiful photos in it, and it's got a real overview of the steepest street in the world.
I feel I should be giving you a couple of dollars for saying that. But
we'll talk about that later. But meanwhile, let's talk about how the projects that you've got coming up, because I heard you say that each project takes a year. So that's pause for thought, isn't it, in terms of, how you want to spend that time of your life. And what are the kind of parameters of why you would take on a project like the next book?
The commissioned ones, obviously, I take it on because someone wants to pay me to write something. Yeah. And if I'm interested in it, I will say yes. But the ones that I come up with, the Arawatta Bill book, going back to that, I was in a park board hut one time, and someone was talking about this guy, Arawatta Bill, and I thought, what an interesting chap. So I was in Timaru a while back, and it was raining and I had nothing to do. I went to the Timaru Library to take out a book on Arawatta Bill, and no one had written one, so I thought, okay, I'll write a book. It was as simple as that.
Right.
I like writing books for myself to read. And if other people enjoy reading them or get something out of them, then that's a bonus. But I really like writing books for myself, finding out for myself.
And how far and wide has your research taken you? Is it always kind of localised?
I know.
I
spend a lot of time in Wellington at Archives New Zealand and National Library and other places. I mean, if you're writing a book on A.H. Reid, you go up to Northland, to the Cowrie Gum Fields where he worked, and you go to Auckland where he worked. And so you go to the places that people were, and there's something left there about them.
Can you travel anywhere without not having that in the back of your mind that you must drop into, the local museum or something?
I want to visit museums at any rate, but it's good. I like working holidays. If I go to Wellington to do a week of research, I'll take a week to come back, via the West Coast. So it's nice to combine work and play like that,
right?
Especially if you're writing books, again, not on commission with a deadline, but writing them for yourself, it's quite relaxing.
Are there any, I don't want to jinx it to talk about sort of future projects, but are there some things that you can talk about that you're working on currently?
I've got some ideas, but I think it's bad luck to say I'm going to write a book on this and that. At the moment I'm writing an article. I'm turning my book on James Brown, the Dunedin cartoonist, into an article for New Zealand Memories magazine, and I know that that will be published, and so I can tell you about that one. But the other ones, they're ideas, and I've done a wee bit of work on them, but whether they end up as a book, I don't know.
So you haven't got a major commission on at the moment?
No commission work. Oh, no, thank you. No, if anybody's wanting someone to write a book about an organisation or a family or anything, I'm in the phone book. And
What I meant was that, I was just going to ask you if you were, were you through that process, are you in the research or the writing thing? And is there either one of those things that you enjoy more than the other?
No, I don't think so. And these days with with linear writing on a computer rather than having a typewriter. I write as I research because I'm not committing myself to something with a typewriter. And
no, you're just sort of taking notes kind of effectively,
notes sort of
aren't
thing.
You?
No, yeah. I don't do 6 months research and 6 months writing consecutively. I research and write at the same time, which I enjoy. I mean, you spend a day in the Hocken Library and then you go back and you write that up. It's a good way to work. And again, with computers and Word documents, you're able to do that. You're able to play around with stuff and not commit yourself to something as you would with a typewriter.
Oh, look, thanks, Ian. That's been really great talking to you. And I could, you know, talk to you for the rest of the day if we had the time. But what it's lovely to see and hear is as a writer that really enjoys their work, you know, like you're obviously, your passions come through. And the fact that you're able to, you know, make a living out of it, I congratulate you. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Joe here. I hope you're keeping well. It's the 21st of December. Now they're ringing the last bell. If I get good behavior, I'll be out of here by July. Won't you kiss my kids on Christmas Day? Please don't let them cry for me. I guess the brothers are driving down from Queensland, and Stella's flying in from the coast. They say it's gonna be 100 degrees, even more maybe, but that won't stop the road. Who's gonna make the gravy now? I bet it won't taste the same. Just that flour, salt, a little red wine. Get a dollop of tomato sauce for sweetness and that extra tang. And give my love to Angus and to Frank and Dolly. Tell them all I'm sorry. I screwed up this time. And look after Rita. I'll be thinking of her early Christmas morning when I'm standing. Mary's got a new boyfriend. I hope he can hold his own. Do you remember the last one? What was his name again? Just a little too much cologne. And Roger, you know I'm even gonna miss Roger. Cause there's sure as hell no one in here I wanna fight. I'll pray the baby Jesus. Have a Merry Christmas. I'm really gonna miss it. All the treasure and the trash. Later in the evening, I can just imagine you put on Junior Murphy and push the tables back and you dance with Rita. I know you really like her. Just don't hold her too close. Oh brother, please don't stab me in the back. I didn't mean to say that. It's a mind it plays up and multiply this matter. Turns imagination into fact. You know I love.
So that was my personal pick for the Christmas carols, in inverted commas. I always like an alternate version of something, and that was Paul Kelly singing How to Make Gravy, which I think is a lovely redemptive song and something that we should all kind of think about at Christmas. Of course, I would have normally probably played Fairy Tale in New York with Shane McGowan, but as you know, he's just recently passed and we've been hearing that a lot lately, so I wanted the something from Down Under, so thank you, Paul Kelly. Now, my next guest is from the University Bookshop, because of course it's that time of the year when you're going to want to know what are the great things that you've got the time and energy to read over the summer break. So it is my great pleasure to welcome Anna Hook-Sims, who is the Retail Manager and Events Coordinator at the Bookshop. And Anna, you must be having the busiest time.
Kia ora, Beverly. Yeah, it has been absolutely crazy busy, which is absolutely wonderful to see. We've got a lot of people coming in at the moment looking for different book recommendations and just finding that one perfect book or several perfect books for their loved ones.
And you would have had a lot of events and things lately to do with Christmas and book launches and things. What have been some of the recent highlights?
Well, we had the launch of A Liminal Gathering, which was the book edited by Iona Winter, which is a grief almanac. So it's a collection of writing and art, as well as some music. Actually, there's a couple of playlists in the book. So we launched that and had a wonderful turnout for that in late November. And at the moment, we've got some late night Christmas shopping evenings on our Thursday. We're open until 8 o'clock, and we had our Christmas festive do last Thursday, which was phenomenal. Had some lovely mince pies and champagne and had lots of people come along, which was really lovely.
Great.
To see.
Yeah, it's been a big year for the bookshop, isn't it?
It's been very busy. We've hosted at least 30 events across the year, which I think boils down to approximately 4 or so a month. Because, of course, January is often quite quiet, and February we're starting to get back into the swing of things. So.
And has the new, well, it's not quite as new, but I mean, in terms of the being back in your original premises and things and hosting functions, that's working better?
Oh, it's just magical having the refurbished building back in our hands. It feels so much more open. I know there are people who really loved the nooks and crannies in the old store, but in terms of hosting events, it's a lot more accessible. We've got a wheelchair and pram access lift, which is wonderful, so we don't have to
upgrade a toilet, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm saying all that because some of you will remember that I did used to help with the events a few years ago, and that's where I met Anna. And it was brilliant for the public, but it was really hard graft behind the scenes, moving the books around. You know, the building was pretty damn Victorian behind the door, wasn't it?
It was quite old. I mean, it used to be a sweet factory, and actually some of the shelving in the old shop that before it was refurbished was actually shelving that was used in the sweet factory, which had been set up in 1910. So it certainly lasted a while. And the hoist, we had a hoist out the back that used to lift all the sweets from the ground floor up to the top and vice versa. So we ended up using that for textbooks.
And running up and down just to get the cheese platters and, you know, like that kind of thing, up and down the stairs into the staff, the staff room and things like that. Yeah,
certainly good exercise. Yeah. We got our 10,000 steps a day plus.
That is true. That is true. But don't miss all of that. So I'm really pleased. No, but I'm also pleased for the team at the bookshop because, you know, they work hard in the day and then to host at night as well. You know, like it's a big ask, but you get a loyal crowd, you know, the writing community loves you. You're so supportive. So, and, you know, thank you obviously for sponsoring this show as well. So let's move into just before we get into the books, another thing that you do for the writing community is the relatively new residency of the Emerging Writers Residency, which is kind of between the bookshop and the Robert Lord Cottage people.
Is.
Yeah. Do you want to just talk about who the recipient is and how that came about this year?
So the recipient for early 2024 is Dr. April Rose Gears. Now she's a lecturer at the University of Canterbury. And we had a wonderful selection of writers apply. It was actually I mean, everybody always says this, it was really hard to choose, but we had to narrow down applications from about 30 or so emerging writers around the country, just down to the one. And so it took several hours to go through and then meet with the people over Zoom and hear a bit about their writing pieces. And there are some emerging writers out there. I cannot wait until I see their books launched. But April really struck us with her work. So she's a poetry activist. Mm. And so she's been corresponding with a woman in prison in Iran.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And so what she wants to do while she's down in Dunedin is a non-fiction piece of work that collates some of the poetry that she's written, as well as her 8 years of research and journal entries in terms of collaborating with this woman and why she's been imprisoned. So this woman has managed to smuggle in prison in Iran has managed to smuggle out some of her poems as well. So April would write to her, I think weekly it was.
Gosh,
and it just struck me as something that's so topical at the moment, and the way that April wants to give back to the community when she's here was really warming and something that really struck us when we interviewed her.
And she, we're down here for, I think, for 6 weeks or
yes.
so, and you support her with kind of the admin side of it in terms of printing and photocopying or what anything.
Yeah,
you know,
so
like
if she wants, she's more than welcome to come and work at UBS, and she's got the Robert Lord Cottage to reside in.
Mm.
But essentially, she's got the city at her fingertips.
And I look forward to meeting her, and I'm really hoping to interview her for our January show. But the thing of, you know, just when you're talking about writing, April writing to someone in prison and things, that's quite a strong part of the NZSA, their PEN program.
It is. Yeah.
You know, because there are imprisoned writers all around the world to do with censorship or, you know, the regimes that they're living under and things like that. So actually it'd be brilliant that she's here to sort of make that even more like personal, because the personal
yes.
is political, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
So yeah, so that's she sounds like a fabulous choice. All right, well let's move on from that into summer reading, which, you know, we want a bit of light and dark in that as well, don't we? I think. Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Well, over to you and tell us some of your choices and why.
So I've got a couple of choices off the top of my head that I'm sure some of you will already know about some of these titles. So my favourite one for this year has been The Axeman's Carnival by Catherine Chidgey. And if you don't know about this book, it's narrated by a magpie called Tama, who is cheeky and witty and beautifully carries the story. Now, it's set in central Otago on a farm there, and it's about a man and a woman who are married and the struggles in their relationship. And when I say struggles, it is a sense of foreboding. There is a bit of domestic violence.
Wow.
And throughout the book, there's a sense that something's going to happen, but to who and when and what is a mystery.
But you can feel the tension as you're reading,
you
so you're going to want to keep reading.
Exactly.
You? Yeah.
And I could just picture myself sitting on the fence paling, like watching the story unfold. So they're struggling with financial issues, and Tama kind of comes along at a perfect moment and is I don't want to say used, but put into play, essentially, as an Instagram star.
Wow. Okay.
And it's really quite cool because Catherine, who I was very fortunate to meet at the booksellers conference in Rotorua earlier this year, has an Instagram account for Tama as well. And she posts the most wonderful photos on there. So there's one of him as an egg, and he's like, "Oh, look at me. This is me when I was a baby." So they're quite funny wee posts. So that's my top pick.
Fabulous. Okay. Let's keep going.
If you want another one, is Wifedom by Anna Funda. Now, The Guardian has labelled it a brilliant reckoning with George Orwell to change the way you read. And so this is all about Eileen O'Shaughnessy, his George Orwell's wife, and essentially all the work she did behind the scenes to help his writing and edit his writing. And perhaps some of the credit that has gone George Orwell's way was perhaps meant really for Eileen. So it's a technically it's a biography, but it does mix fiction in.
Is it easy reading or is it quite challenging reading?
I wouldn't have said it was a challenging read at all. I mean, I guess in a way challenging reading appeals to me, so I might be a bit biased when I say I don't find it challenging. I probably wouldn't say it was like a really easy pickup, you know, like a Jack Reacher. It's not an easy read in that sense. But I wouldn't have said it was a challenge. No, it's not like it's like Duck Newburyport where it was all 1,000 pages were one parable, one sentence.
Right.
Yeah, so not challenging in that way.
But it's a book that needs to be said and, you know, like acknowledged.
Yes.
Yeah. So someone coming out into the sunlight. Yeah.
Yes, because, I mean, Eileen went to Oxford on a scholarship, but unfortunately dropped out so her husband could write. So another one I've got here is O Miriam. So this is Miriam Margolyes' Stories from an Extraordinary Life. I don't really feel I need to say much more
about
that.
Because if you've seen her on Graham Norton,
I was just going to say, frequent visitor to Graham Norton. What a wonderful Professor Sprout and
Harry
Potter.
Very talented actor.
Incredibly.
And it's quite hard to watch her in a series. And it's not hard to watch her in a series at all because she's incredibly convincing, but you're almost expecting her to sort of fart or burp or something, aren't you? You know, like she is very irreverent. And I'm sure although she kind of implied that, because this is her second memoir, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, and I think the first one she did the shocking stuff. And I think
there's always something shocking with her,
probably,
though.
Probably there is, yes.
But yes, slightly more tame, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah.
But filling in some more blanks about her, you know, as you say, extraordinary life, because she's well in her 80s now, I think, isn't she?
Yeah. I think so, yes. Yeah.
Great. So that's a great one for the beach or the batch because you can probably pick it up and put it down.
I think, it's a wonderful dip in, dip out.
Which I think is really important at this time of the year. Okay.
Another one I've got here is Great Uncle Harry by Michael Palin. Now, this is a wonderful story. It's a quest that followed hundreds of hours of detective work, essentially, by the author to trace out his own great uncle's journey from the comfort of a middle-class Victorian childhood through the railways and tea plantations in India to a farm in New Zealand and then to Gallipoli.
Oh, so there's a New Zealand link in that
there
one.
There is a New Zealand link in this one and then Flanders. So gripping, sad, but a wonderful historical look over somebody's life and the different routes they've taken.
So that literally is world. Michael Palin's uncle.
Yes,
great uncle. So was he able to separate out the family connection from making it a story available to other readers, if you know what I mean? Or was it quite a personal?
Look, so he walked the routes that that Harry took on the last day of his life, of his great uncle's life, in the mud in northern France. So I think in some ways it is very personal, but in other times he is able to distance himself and write about it from, you know, slightly further back.
Right, the sort of the context of this is one man, but this is what was going on around.
Yes, I think it's a good mix.
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And then the last one I've got here is a cookbook.
Oh.
Now, this is Tina Duncan's cookbook. It's Plated. So it's a lifetime love affair with food. And it's one of my top picks for Christmas and summer because the photos in here are beautiful. The way she set it out is lovely. It's clear and clean. The images pop and the recipes are really easy to follow. It's, you know, you don't have to go foraging for special mushrooms or something like that. This is all easily accessible food.
Can you give us a bit of, sorry, I don't know Tina Duncan, so as a chef, can you give us a bit of context about her?
Look, I have to admit, I mostly read fiction and history and crime, and I dip in and out of cookbooks. I don't know a lot about her other than that she's had a catering company.
Is she based here in New Zealand or is she Australian? Or
She is a New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Yeah,
okay.
She's a New Zealand
right.
chef. So her dad grew peas for Watties and was a traditional farmer. And her mum was a dressmaker, cook and gardener. So I think with that background, I think that's sort of given her some good stepping stones. Yeah. And she's got in the book that by the time she was 12, she'd cook a full dinner party.
Gracious.
So I can't ever imagine at 12 being able to do a full dinner party. In fact, that would probably leave me quaking in my boots.
I used to make bacon egg pie for the family Sunday, Saturday lunch and think that was, you know, I was the star of the show.
Yeah. Well, fair enough, because I wasn't doing that.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
It was
you know, I think at that age you always have a one-dish wonder, don't
you?
You
do,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, you can do nachos or you can do, you know, some sort of egg dish or something, you know, and mine was bacon egg pie.
I think was those little bread muffins that you can make. You get a slice of bread, pop it in a muffin tray, fill it with egg and bacon
and stuff.
And, yes, and corn.
Yes,
yeah, and
yes.
It was me.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. All right, have you got any other personal favourites there?
Oh, look, they were my top five.
Okay.
So
great
were
range of things.
Ones. Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, I might just drop in a couple that I've read this year because, you know, like Anna, I'm a prolific reader as well. I probably read about 80 books a year, and that sounds about what you do as well, Anna. And I understand that your home is looking more and more like your work.
Oh, it's incredible.
The number
I've got seven bookcases and throwings.
Whereas I tried to do a one in, one out, because otherwise I wouldn't get to my front door. But I'd particularly, and this is a range and in no particular order, of the books I've read recently, ones that I'd recommend to other to listeners to read over the summer would be Landed by Sue McCauley. Mm. Now, Sue hasn't written a book for a long time, but it's a kind of family saga to do with, you know, land and inheritance. And so there's a bit of tension there, but it was just very nuanced and perceptive, I thought. So I thought that is a good all-rounder. The other one I'd really like to recommend would be Laughing at the Dark.
Oh,
which,
Barbara.
Yeah, of course, Barbara. Barbara's not only a local writer, but she's going to be next year's President of Honour, which is an absolute triumph given her the health issues that she's faced to recover to that point is absolutely fantastic. And what I really liked about it was it's sort of a memoir of manners and mores and things. And just when you were talking about the George Bernard Shaw example and that, I was kind of, you know, in a different way, in a more modern way, it's the same thing. It was, you know, because for Barbara, she was having to kind of play the nice girl, you know, and then be the good wife and the good mother and those sorts of things. So honestly, listeners, if you've know someone in their 70s, if you want to buy it for your mum, or know someone who's lived through the 1970s, then I couldn't recommend it highly enough. And what kind of shocked me is that Barbara's only 10 years older than me, and yet because I came from small town New Zealand, some of those kind of manners and patriarchy and things, I was battling them as well, and I wasn't alone in that. So I think for a lot of people, they'll be having an aha moment when they read what Barbara's story, because it is it's sort of quite some of it's quite specific, but a lot of it's quite universal to it's of its time, you know, and it's great that you get the acknowledgement there, but it's always also disturbing, you know, because you think, for goodness sake,
not that long ago, have we moved on?
And then just for a complete change of pace, I'm not sure if you've read this one, Anna, but The Breakneck Speed of Poor People with Money.
Oh, yes, I did read that.
Dominic Hoare.
Yeah.
I mean, just, it's kind of like an updated Metropolitan Once Were Warriors.
I was just going to say Once Were Warriors, yes.
Once Were Warriors, but also the kind of black humour of Outrageous Fortune.
Yes,
you know, because these are characters that have got nothing left to lose.
No.
And so they sort of behave badly, but their circumstances, that's normal, you know. So it's he's such a dynamic writer. I think he's one to watch. I know he's got another book coming out
soon.
And, you know, giddy up, you know, like if you read it, just go for the ride.
Mm.
So
I couldn't put that one down, actually. I can still remember getting towards the end and thinking, oh my gosh, it's midnight. No, I've got to keep going.
Yeah, you want to know how it ends, but actually it's quite unresolved, isn't it? Because it's, in a way, it's just clearly their lives and you're just getting a glimpse of it.
Mm.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, well, thank you very much, Anna. And don't forget that you can go to the bookshop right at when's your last day of trading before Christmas. It'll be right on Christmas Eve.
It will be Christmas Eve, yes.
Yeah. Great.
So come on down and say hello. We're always happy to help out with book recommendations too if you're stuck for that relative that you just don't quite know what
Anna's
to buy for.
A book whisperer. You just give her three clues and she will pick absolutely the right book. If not for you, then anyone else you're buying gifts for Christmas. Well, thanks very much, Anna.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me on today. It's been wonderful, Beverly.
Absolute pleasure. And that's our show for this month. And we'll Merry Christmas and we'll see you all in the new year. So good writing, good reading. Have a break, people. You deserve it. And we'll see you back fresh in January. All right.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.